Welcome to Grodje Framework, or Grodje in Slovenian. We have a new episode of Borderless. So Borderless, we host international speakers, we speak in English. Grodje is a Slovenian tech dev podcast. I hope you know that.
By now.
By now, yeah. And today we have a special guest, Nick Jackson, principal developer advocate at HashiCorp. Welcome to Grodje.
Thank you very much.
And you should mention where we are sitting right now, because this is not our like usual place where we record.
Yeah. So today you won't hear any trains that you usually do or every emergency vehicles driving by. Today we are here at Delft's Days Ljubljana. We are at FREE, so the Faculty of Informatics and Computer Science. So yeah, it's a great venue. We decided not to close ourselves into a room super quietly, so you can enjoy some noise in the background. Woo!
Yeah, but if you listen to the previous episode, we had like similar situation, so like this is like the new setting right now.
Yeah, and our technicians are actually amazing. They're doing some black magic, no fun intended, and they're basically just erasing every noisy thing in the background, or at least as much as they can do.
Nice.
Yeah, how are you doing, Nick?
I'm very well. Are you both well as well, I hope?
Yeah. So today we are both, our team from Grodje is Andraš, and I'm also Andraš. We have a bunch of folks here.
And if somebody's missing Otto, he's there.
Yeah. Our producer with a nice smile. Should we jump in?
So now we're here at DevOps Days Ljubljana, and so today's episode is going to be more of a discussing the DevOps culture, the hype. Are we still in the hype phase? And everything related, whether this is like culture, whether these are tooling that are sort of a byproduct that's eventually happened. I don't know where should like start. Maybe leaving you the hard question. How I'm assuming that like this is not your first DevOps days. In general, that you've been like with your professional career, with HashiCorp supporting this kind of events and so on. So how do you see I don't know, 10 years ago, whether and compare it to where we stand now?
With regard to, well, so this is actually my first DevOps days. I can't believe it. I've been doing this role for nearly 7 years. I've never spoken at a DevOps days, and I don't know why, but I've just never done it. So I'm actually really excited to be here. I think DevOps is growing from strength to strength as a kind of a first thing. So like when I first came across the term, which was probably around 10 years or so, around about maybe a little more, but I think DevOps at the time was about trying to drive that shift from just sort of system administration, but trying to get more involvement. And I think we're slowly getting there. I mean, it's taken a long time, but I look at my background. So my background, I'm an application developer. I've run engineering teams. I am literally the sort of person that you would not want anywhere near a server, because I will do things in a very specific developer's way, which is root credentials for everything and chmod 777, right? But I think the thing for me is that, and I hope I'm the perfect example of this, is that I see the benefit hugely in the DevOps culture, because I've seen the benefits firsthand. And for me, I was always interested in the sort of system admin side and what's going on with the infrastructure, because I wanted to help to get that to move forward, because I want my applications to get into production. I want my production environment to be running smoothly, because nobody likes getting up. So by taking an interest in the kind of the operational side of things, then I think that really helps. And then you look at it from the other side as well. So from an operations person, by an operational side of things, taking an interest in the application development, understanding you know, some of the constraints and the technical limitations of the application, it helps you to build better infrastructure. And that kind of mesh and that sort of culture, I think, is really, you know, really, really, really helping us. So I'm pleased to see that things are moving along. I have a worry.
that's good to hear. Yeah.
Yeah. And I have a worry that what we've seen, I think, emerging in the last 12 months is I hear a lot of platform engineering. And I hear this is a lot of, in terminology. Now, I appreciate why platform engineering as a thing exists, because people are increasingly needing these complicated systems. So therefore, we're kind of, rather than kind of each individual silo building their own systems, they're trying to kind of centralize that as a capability. The thing that I worry about platform engineering is that the developers who had been getting really good at integrating with an operational side of things, getting involved with provisioning infrastructure, deploying their own code, is now going to go back to the way that they were 10 years ago and start thinking, not my job anymore, not my problem. And I think that is a worry for me. I don't know if that's happening. I don't know if it will happen, but it feels, I think labels are a very powerful and in some ways dangerous thing. I don't know what you guys think about that. I mean,
I've seen, like, in last decade, I see similar to the point that this is sort of become nice to have. Let's talk about it. Let's like break all the silos and work together. But in the end, we are still struggling with similar things as before. And yeah, like, there still are labels and sort of like, this is not my job at the end of the day. So I'm sort of also worried whether are we still like preaching this sort of a cult, or we are making actual like improvement let's say development on operation stuff. So I should also stand this like more worried side, no matter that I'm no longer so much involved in this culture. Maybe Andras could like fill me in his perspective that what his is.
Yeah, I would say it this way, like, it's everybody wants to be as good as the big boys, right? And if you want to be as good as big companies, even if you're maybe smaller or a startup, you want to do things proper. And once you want to do the things proper, you need to specialize in technologies.
Yeah.
And the thing that I'm seeing is there's, for example, when it comes to Kubernetes, it's a great framework and a tool, but you need a super dedicated person to manage that, especially if we are talking about intermediate level of people that are maybe 5 years in their career. So it's not Kubernetes is just another technology. They need to focus on that. And then you are starting to lose this contact when it comes just to, hey, we want to provide business value. Yeah. Let's just create a simple, I don't know, Ansible pipeline that will do the job and everybody will understand.
Yeah.
But which I think it's manageable by the whole team, or by developers. But when it comes to the technologies that really the big companies are using, and it might be a bit complex for the most of the team, then you're having basically this disconnect because somebody really specializes on something and it's hard to deploy. And then you get this gap. I think that basically people have this fear of missing out or looking at social media, what is fancy, and it might be super overcomplicated for them.
Yeah.
I don't know if you share the same thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, I remember the Kelsey Hightower, when he kind of did his own meme where he was like, you know, hey, I'm going to deploy my blog to Kubernetes. And I think that's a sort of an appreciable problem. I think in general, Kubernetes sort of solves a problem that we have, which is that we need to run these smaller instances of applications across a distributed environment. And with anything like that, it comes complexity. I kind of think that as well, that to your point around sort of people learning, it can actually be really difficult. So when I started out my career, Nelly, well, I graduated nearly 30 years ago, but my first real job when I was working in the internet, and I built a website for Formula One. And at the time, that website for the global Formula One was running on two servers. We had an Apache front end server, which was running PHP, and we had an Oracle server, which was serving as the database. Two Sun Solaris boxes, and okay, there was like three people on the internet at the time, so it wasn't a thing. But in terms of the complexity of what you need to learn as an app dev, I needed to learn a little bit of Linux. Mm. I needed to learn roughly, you know, like the rough edges of how Apache works, like what is the configuration to sort of deploy an application, and to configure things like the plugin for PHP. And I needed to understand PHP and some SQL. Nothing too heavy. And nowadays, I need to understand, let's assume I'm still working in PHP. I need to understand my PHP. I need to understand Kubernetes, because I need to understand how the application is going to be deployed. I need to understand the underlying structure of what's going on in the Kube cluster, because, well, I need, you know, if I understand how the nodes are being scheduled, or if they're in auto scale groups, and how that affects load balancing, and how that affects the applications coming and going, and I need to understand how to deploy it. So I need something like Terraform or Ansible or Chef, or insert probably all of those tools here. And then I need to understand sort of functional testing and half a dozen different databases. It's pretty complex. I mean, the world is definitely getting more and more complex, but like at the same time, it's pretty interesting. And so I suppose like this is maybe where we're guilty, right? We look at these new technologies and we're like, oh my God, that's something else that's really interesting. We can't get captivated by something.
So you think we in a way overcomplex everything by pushing too much new in technology or like new things into our stacks? Because the last time I was like reading the how the infrastructure of Stack Overflow is looking, and it's simple. They still like keep it very simple for the things that they need.
Yeah.
And if like you compare this to somebody else who would like start doing the architecture design, would say no, we need something that's like Kubernetes in, we need load balancer here, we need like, and in the end, like what Andraš mentioned, like maybe that's not like, but like understanding the business, we are like more focusing on the nice technology, nice to have, maybe all the features that will never be used, but it's like having this, it's sort of something to brag about in the end.
I mean, I don't know if it's, I think it's, so I think firstly, the sort of software architecture is difficult. So I think getting, architecting a system for the correct scale is also very, very difficult. And then you've got complexity of application. So something like, I don't want to play down Stack Overflow, but you know, if you have like a sort of a website, which is a kind of a forum, then the number of components are somewhat smaller or constrained than say you have a global banking system.
Yeah.
Or, you know, take something like sort of Netflix, which is like, what about like 40% of all internet traffic or something like that. So then I think what happens is we sort of learn a lot, and we're reading a lot, and we're looking at these solutions. So we're building our startup, and we're going to grow as big as Netflix. That's our goal, but we're not there yet. But what we're doing is maybe architecting the solution at the wrong level at the wrong point. So instead of starting out with something which is a little bit simpler and then progressing outwards, you know, to give you an example, like containerization is still a great thing. It enables a great developer workflow. So I would always recommend containerization at any scale. But you don't need to start with Kubernetes. You could start with Cloud Run, or like ECS is actually really, really quite accessible. Or like, the, you know, pretty much every sort of cloud provider has a run a container as an instance. And then you can scale it out from there. So then as you add more services, you maybe add another Cloud Run instance. And then maybe you can like, okay, we're going to start managing these with infrastructure as code and building some pipelines. And then you're going to get to a point that's like, okay, we're at a point now where the application needs multiple instances or having issues with deployment. Then you start to look for the architectural solutions. I think I think if anything, what we're guilty of is we'll kind of read something on an article and think, that'd be amazing, I'd love to implement that. And then you implement it without actually thinking, well, do you really need it? But at the same time, like, I don't think people do that deliberately. I think it's just really hard to kind of, there's so much information, so much complexity. It's like, where do you even begin? And with hindsight, if you've got a bunch of years experience building various systems of sizes, you kind of get to learn which is the right solution. But if you kind of don't, and all you're doing is like, well, how do I deploy my application to the cloud? If you Google that, yeah, you're probably going to come across like, oh, here's an article on how to do it with Terraform and Kubernetes. And if you don't know it any better, that's your starting point, when it's not necessarily the appropriate solution for. So yeah, I think it's hard, but at the same time, like, you know, I'm a magpie like anybody else. I find it super interesting. I'm all about the new technology.
Yeah, it's hard to balance our excitement with some boring technology from the past that might be a bit more practical, or, well, depends on the use case. But yeah, it's super tricky. So recent years, we are seeing that HR departments or companies are basically posting job titles like DevOps engineer. What does that mean for you?
Well, I mean, when I kind of look at those things, and I see, first and foremost, I think DevOps is a culture.
Yeah.
And, you know, it is what it is. It's dev and it's ops. But at the same time, it's also a methodology. So you can't just say it's a culture. You know, it's about, in my mind as well, if you look and say, well, what is DevOps? It's about performing an operational function, but using maybe a development process. So we're using infrastructure as code, we're building tooling to help us. So, you know, you, like, a lot of DevOps engineers are writing sort of pretty complex scripts and their own tools using Python or Go or Rust or whatever. So it is kind of a meld of the two. Like, I know a lot of people kind of get upset with the whole, like, DevOps when they say it as a title. I'm like, well, I don't like have a problem with that. Like, I think it's just embodying that kind of that attitude, if you would, and if it helps as well. Like, if having a label helps promote a methodology or promote a culture, like, that's not a bad thing, is it? I don't know. What do you ask the question? I'm going to ask you the question. What do you think?
Yeah, I always find it tricky, right? Whenever I go to my customer, I try to figure out what do they want. And I know that sounds a bit funny, but you really can't assume anything,
yeah.
Especially in DevOps related stuff, right? Because sometimes people just want me to help them from end to end, and maybe just like lift up the knowledge of the whole team and the whole process, and that might be from development to delivery. Sometimes they're super focused just on CI/CD pipelines,
yeah.
So I need to basically figure out what they want there. But the main thing, at least the main challenge for me, is when I started gaining years and years of experience, I go to the customer and I say, look, we have, I don't know, there are four zones of technology that we can pick, and I recommend that we pick something that everybody can learn something, and that we don't go full crazy.
Yeah.
Right. So that it's actually that the business folks or the main company, so that they are happy that the engineers just didn't close the door and now they are geeking out,
yeah.
Right. But I also want to, depends on the level of the folks working there or my customers, I also want to share whatever I know.
Yes.
Right. And I say, look, there's no need to use Docker. We can totally use package managers that are purely functional, and we just use Nix and we can figure,
yep,
everything out. But that might be ultra overkill, right? And I never do that suggestion. Also, but I've done some consulting in that. And sometimes I'm just like, and I know that this will sound super wrong. If you have two guys and they don't have any funding, they have a bootstrap company and they commit their secrets into the repo and the repo is private. Uh-huh. I'm like, look, it's fine, right? Because this company might not exist in 3 weeks,
yeah,
right? But I will tell you all the technologies and maybe we can agree that you maybe should do a small step and, for example, take Mozilla SOPs.
Yeah.
If you can implement that in your thinking and how you deploy stuff, it's still in GitHub. It's just simple executable that will help manage this and I can help you set up those things up. If you are willing to spend or pay me actually 2 hours of my work, is that a price performance for you? And or if they say no, then I'm saying, look, then just put them at one place so that at one point, if you succeed, you will know where to rotate,
yeah,
right? And basic things like that. So for me, when I go somewhere, and I usually don't apply to job postings, right? But yeah, the main challenge for me is I need to shift or bend the job DevOps engineer posting. I need to bend that inquiry to something that that makes sense for my customer and
yeah,
for me.
And I think that is a problem, I suppose. But it's a problem, but it's such a broad spectrum.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
I think that's the key thing. It's about ultimately what you want to do is just move the bar. It's about just incremental progression. That's what everybody should be trying to do. But like, I definitely enjoy working in a world which has DevOps a lot more than the previous, you know, the sort of where you had a dedicated sysadmin who was grumpy and would basically answer your request, maybe, if you were lucky, certainly not on a Friday because you've probably been drinking since lunchtime because, well, you know, dealing with developers all week, I would too.
So this methodology is not for grumpy people. So grumpy people are not in DevOps, right?
I think in tech we're pretty good at being.
Yeah, No. I agree. I was like adding to your question whether like DevOps. I see DevOps as like right now overhyped, like using Kubernetes.
Yeah.
I see like it's maybe too much stress saying, well, this is a DevOps job. Well, come on, we're like using this culture, like culture norm. Understanding each unit or from management to business perspective to development perspective and operation perspective and be like transparent to like be everybody involved. I rather see this like to be this like open process and can call it DevOps, and then like whether not be having title DevOps, it makes far more sense like Google introduced the SREs, far more fancy title, but nevertheless I'm just fine saying that he's a sysadmin, but practicing this good cultural practices of communication, open transparency and wanting to like you said, moving things forward, and not saying, well, it's not my job here, like my responsibility ends, and not willing to maybe help the other party to move things forward.
Yeah, and I think as well, I've just had a thought that maybe what we're suppose a problem that we have in the industry as well is you are basically paid by what you know. So the amount of stuff that's in your head, the more tools and knowledge you have, and obviously experience of developing systems, is pretty much kind of, you know, directly linked to the amount of salary that you get. So therefore, if you want to get more salary, you need to know more stuff. Mm-hmm. So therefore, I think there's also like a demand that we want to keep learning, but then you want to kind of implement what you've learned and practice. So maybe that also is kind of a driver on why we're using, in some cases, inappropriate use of technology. And maybe we need to like flip this as a business. And it, and in the reality is, it shouldn't be about what you know. It should be about the efficiency that you can drive within the organization. Yeah. Now, actually, having a broad spectrum of knowledge helps you to understand that maybe the most complex tool is not the right tool. And actually, the best solution for the business, which derives the best value and efficiency, is the simplest tool. And avoiding the Kubernetes and going for just the, you know, we just need a VM, so let's just create a VM. So maybe we need to kind of think about that as well. But I certainly think, I mean, like, you know this yourselves, like if you saw a role and it was high tech, you might be more attracted to go for that. It's probably higher salary as well, as opposed to if it was a high salary but low tech role. You know, so maybe we're our own worst enemies.
Yeah, but on the other hand, you could see, like, especially what I saw in the last decade were like those jobs that have these fancy descriptions, what kind of technology you'll be using, but in the end, you're like stuck with some legacy. Like, they maybe have something in a roadmap. We want to be there, but you will need the working process how to get there, but you're basically stuck with some legacy technology.
I find those kinds of things the most interesting. Like, for me, I think I'm really interested in that, how to get from point A to point B. So if somebody comes along and says, we have this Rails application, it's a monolith, it's just a Rails app with a Postgres database, we have an aspiration to grow the business, to add technology which will ultimately lead to developing all of these new services, I think that's actually really interesting, because then you sort of think, well, how do you decompose this? How do you start extracting components out of this? What is the appropriate way to run this new architecture? And you see it grow, and you see it evolve, and hopefully with it you see the business grow. And I think that's always been a focus that, like, we shouldn't forget that we were employed to help provide a sort of a service to provide a value for an organization. And so maybe basically we just need more businesses to like start giving us money based on, If they're more successful, they should pay us more. Right? That sounds fair, right?
Yeah.
I'm all for more money.
Yeah. So less hype-driven hiring.
Yeah, and like, but I think in general, right? Like, I think if you look at DevOps, and if you've spoken to certain business leaders, they will use the term, and they haven't really got an understanding of what's going on. They don't really get it. But even if that term is a leverage to be able to drive a conversation in finance, to be able to drive a conversation with a C-level somewhere, which increases funding for technology or for whatever that the organization then needs to help it push forward, then that's a good thing. Like, I've got no problem at all with that if somebody's kind of using that, but because we all win in the end.
Yeah.
Do you think that maybe in the next few years we will? In the recent years, there had been a lot of tooling regarding delivery and how to ship something to production, and I would say that back in the 2000s, there were, including me, a lot of sysadmins that were happy with just like simple bash scripts, and we didn't really care much with coding back then. Of course, at least I was less experienced, so you need to grow that skill of coding. And now we are in a renaissance where there is a lot of new tools popping up. And I compare that, and I know it's a weird comparison, a bit to the front end world, when there was a period that there had been a lot of frameworks, but now we are basically settled on the three major ones, kinda. Yeah. Of course, there are newer ones, but there is React, Vue.js, and Angular, and they seem to be the options that big companies pick. Do you think that maybe we will agree on some tooling in some department, so we will be able to be more rational and then think back how to provide more value and just not hack on new things?
I think it's a good question. And I think until I think until we get to a situation when the tooling is really suitable for what we need in order to do our jobs, we're gonna, I think, still have evolution. I think there is a slow sort of standardization around sort of certain tools, which I think is a good thing, because then you have the knowledge sharing is kind of more focused, which is always good. But I'm still not convinced that where we are right now, that the tools deliver exactly what we need. And that's why we need to continually build things. And again, this is why I think that every organization has a platform engineering team, because there isn't something that we can just pick up off the shelf and that we can use. And so I think there will be a consolidation. I think it will kind of happen, but it seems like certainly over the last sort of 5 years, from an architectural standpoint, where we're not slowing down, but we seem to be organizing our thought around the two predominant patterns of like either the serverless pattern or the kind of the Kubernetes or scheduler based pattern. That doesn't seem to be, there's certainly nobody's come up with a new, well, I'm having said that, and I'm like, well, we're all going to be probably writing serverless WASM functions running on Kubernetes, obviously, in the next the next 5 years. So maybe we are about to shift again, but it does feel like we're starting to consolidate our infrastructure patterns, and then I think because of that, the tooling will then become standardized. So I think it'll happen, but I think there's always, whilst we're all building our own platforms, there's always going to be custom tooling required, because what I build is not necessarily going to be useful for you and or you or.
Yeah, but like we can simply like basically your employer, so HashiCorp, so basically was solving some of their own issues and create tools to figure out those tools get benefit to wide range of customers.
Yeah.
And I'm
excited about that. And then like, so I don't know if any of the listeners haven't kind of got a full background on that, but when Mitchell and Armon basically were working in a role as DevOps engineers, and they were deploying systems, and they realized at kind of the forefront of cloud that the tooling was, there was something missing basically. Now, this is just after Vagrant. So they started to kind of think about this and started to build the tooling. And then they realized that actually, hang on a minute, if this tooling is useful for us, then it's probably useful for the wider market. And then that was when they founded HashiCorp to actually start working on that full time. And back then, you were looking at sort of Vagrant and Terraform and Packer. And then HashiCorp built the first version of Terraform Cloud, which was then called Atlas. Mm-hmm. And we needed a secrets manager. So there wasn't a secrets manager. So internally, they were like, oh, well, we need to build this secrets service. So they built Vault. And then after Vault had been built, which was specifically designed just for the first version of Terraform Cloud, somebody was like, well, hang on a minute, that's actually really useful. We should make that a tool for other people to use. And I think having that ethos has been really, really useful. So I hope that we'll see a lot more companies that do exactly the same thing. It might be some engineers who are working for an organization and they built a really useful tool. Then they go and they set up a startup and they can build that tool and work on it and allow, it solves the problem for everyone else. I think that's a really nice way of developing software rather than, the kind of the just sitting around thinking about what should we build. When you've got an actual need which is based on knowledge of the problem, I think you create really, really good software. And I think I'm hopeful we'll see a lot more of that.
Yeah, but we saw this sort of a good practices in the past, like the company, like out my mind, top of my mind right now is maybe like Netflix, open source their Chaos Monkey project and so on. So basically each company is sort of a development in its own tooling for suiting that needs and figure out, well, maybe somebody else is having similar problems.
Yeah.
Let's work on this. And I see a lot of nice open source software or tools came out of that and sort of a community growth out of that and people contributed to this. So it seems like a lot's been going on in that sense.
Yeah. I mean, I think like in general, that whole sort of change in the way that we share information has been like huge. From, I remember the when I was at university and I was studying at university, I needed Linux. And back in the day, you didn't have much of a modem, right? But I bought a book, a textbook from a bookstore, and it came with a CD of, I think it was SUSE.
Mm.
And that was how I got, you know, how I got access to Linux. If I needed some software, I would generally have to pay for it. So like I needed, I remember working on an application, and the application needed to do some very basic image manipulation. Like I'm talking cropping Now I could have wrote that myself, but at the same time, the internet didn't exist. So like determining what is the specification of a JPEG, right? You know, what is the JPEG specification? What's the file format? The actual software frameworks at the time, certainly like ASP.NET, didn't have that capability built in. So it would be a huge amount of effort to try and even do something very, very simple like create a JPEG resizer. And there was no free software to do this. So you had to go and buy a library, which was great for the folks who were selling the libraries, but it meant that everything just went really quite slow. You know, you didn't have the ability to accumulate knowledge. And then, of course, when organizations, I think, started to get and realize that we've got this learning, we've consumed some learning from other people, so let's put back into the industry and share our learning and creating a sort of an open software model, it's just benefiting absolutely everywhere, because now we've got the access to the knowledge. We obviously have access to the tools and to the organizations like Netflix. Like for Netflix to publish their Chaos Monkey is of zero competitive disadvantage to them as a video platform.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of organizations are kind of recognizing that same thing. And I think we're all benefiting hugely, hugely from that.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. Like one thing that I really value about HashiCorp is whatever product was released, it was super well engineered and designed. And I think that a lot of solutions were also solving problems in the most smooth way that you could solve it. I remember, maybe we should just mention a few products, because when I was a youngster, I didn't realize that Vagrant was a HashiCorp product.
Yeah.
And then when there was the era where we were building gold images for virtual machines in the cloud, there was this Packer. And then after a while, I started focusing, you know, if there is a great director that you see a movie and then you're like, okay, that's a great movie. And then you see another movie and you're like, okay, that's also a great movie. And then you're like, oh, but the director is the same, right?
Right.
And then I started being more focused on the company and whatever products they offer. And for example, I was always confused. I know that Nomad is here for a while. It was here before containers arrived, I think.
Around the same. Yeah. So both Nomad and Kubernetes were probably started around about exactly the same time. So it was just post Docker. And when we were kind of starting to starting to consume like Mesos, and which was the most popular scheduler at the time, and kind of wondering if there were other options. Certainly that was where Mitchell and Armon were thinking when they decided to create Nomad, and I'm pretty sure that's where like Joe Bader and all were thinking when they started to think about Kubernetes.
Do you maybe have an idea why Nomad was not picked as much as maybe some different products from HashiCorp?
I think it's...
Is it too simple?
No, I don't think so. Like, I think it's an interesting one. I mean, I suppose, I think one of so if we look at it in terms of timelines, I remember way back, and we were talking about replacing Mesos.
Yeah.
And we wanted to adopt something else. Now, the first time I ever saw Armon, I was speaking at a conference in London, and he was speaking there, talking about Nomad. And so I went to, I was a HashiCorp fan. We were using a lot of their tools at Not on the High Street. So I went to see this talk because I wanted to know what this new scheduler was. And at the time, it was the initial alpha release. It looked really interesting. And Kubernetes at the time was, there was this whole thing about, oh, you shouldn't be running it in production. It's not ready for production. And there were rough edges, as there always are with software. I think the thing that maybe HashiCorp had against it, when in terms of, like, if you want to look at that as a race of some sort, was that the team at HashiCorp that were working on Nomad probably back then were probably about two or three people. And then you have the entire organization and the weight of Google. But I think the key thing around those two things is that folks gravitated to one solution, then you have a sort of an ecosystem that spins up around that. Yeah. And then that accelerates that sort of drive. I think Nomad never really got too much in that. I still think it's a fabulous scheduler, and it would probably be my primary choice because I love the fact that it's so versatile. And it is, I wouldn't say, in some ways it's easier to use, in some ways it's more complex. I think there's pros and cons to everything. But I think it was literally just a thing that this kind of people just sort of said, look, I just want to run containers, then Kubernetes, and then all of the, if you Google how to run a container, you're going to get Kubernetes. It's just a snowball. I don't think Nomad is done by any regards, though. I think Nomad's been there for probably about 7 years now, and I think keep your eyes on it, because I think we're kind of working on some really, really cool stuff. And the versatility of having the capability to schedule multiple different things, VMs, ECS tasks, if you want, Docker containers, raw binaries.
Jar files,
of course, right? Mm-hmm. If you're running Java, if you're like, do you really need to containerize your Java applications? Well, if you're running Kube, the answer is yes. But the thing is, you don't. So I think that versatility could actually be really interesting for when we look at the post-container generation, which I don't think is very far away. I think it was literally just it was appetite in the community. People gravitated towards a particular product. Still a lot of users use Nomad, don't get me wrong. But of course it's not as big as sort of Kubernetes, but they do different things in different ways. I suppose it's whatever your choice is.
Is it, like, based on what you're seeing, is there like the product of HashiCorp that is like far more popular, or saying, well, this is our most popular or most used product? I know all of them are in the whole.
I mean, without a shadow of a doubt, Terraform. Like, without, I mean, I think literally without a shadow. I mean, even if you look at the simplest of metrics around GitHub stars, it far out sort of weighs any of the other tools. I was asking somebody for numbers on this the other day, because I've heard some things. It's definitely in millions. Like, I've heard quotes of the 10 millions. I think they just had a billion downloads of the Terraform AWS provider, which is pretty crazy. And you don't have to go too far it gets mentioned a lot. I mean, when people are talking about things like provisioning infrastructure, creating infrastructure, even deploying applications, it comes up a lot. So it's definitely very, very popular, and I like it as a tool as well. So, I mean, I'm slightly biased, of course, but yeah, probably that. In terms of like what's the second most popular, I mean, you know, console is still powering a huge part of the internet. There are some large numbers of console clusters running. And at one point, I and please don't quote me on this, but I'm sure I read a statistic that it was one of the most deployed applications to things like AWS, because it was like a core part of people's microservice estate. Where that goes with Kubernetes, because obviously Kube has etcd built into it, will we see a shift? Possibly, but at the same time, console has shifted. You know, console has additional capabilities around sort of macro segmentation, service mesh capabilities to bring it into the new world. So it's not gone. And then there's Vault. And Vault is, I think, I don't want to say like it's becoming a sort of an industry standard for secrets management, but it's certainly one of the more mentioned tools when people are looking for a secrets management solution. Well,
I can add that you basically set some goals or some standards regarding Vault, because like I personally tried different or let's say alternative products, and in the end they try to like have the same API or say API calls as you guys did. So to have this transparency and being able to switch to something different. Interesting. I was thinking like I'm surprised that Vagrant is not among first three, because I whenever I joined any developer teams, I saw that like Vagrant is there. Maybe they didn't know about it, but somehow some things are basically running in Vagrant.
I would. You know, I'm going to look up the numbers on this, but I know that Vagrant is still wildly popular. So, and as well, for me, Vagrant was the first HashiCorp tool that I ever used. At the time, I was working at a UK supermarket, and we were wanting to run functional tests for our iOS application and our Android applications. And this needed massive parallelization, and we needed the capability of running a clean room environment. We didn't want to be installing software on top of software. Now, specifically for Apple, and this is, you know, we're going back nearly 10 years now, there was no way to kind of just virtualize an OS X instance. You could spin up OS X on an OS X, I'm sorry, on an Apple machine using VMware. So what we did was we used Vagrant to basically spin up these virtual machines on Apple hardware, which was pre-configured. Then we could use this to execute our functional tests, and we were kind of orchestrating all of that with Jenkins, and it worked great. Like, you know, long before any of the sort of there was any sort of CI based platforms to do this, and that was my introduction to Vagrant. So then I started to use it for building development machines, but at the same time, I also discovered things like Docker, and for me, like if I just needed a Postgre database, which I mostly did for my development work or something along those lines, spinning that up in Docker was incredibly fast. But Vagrant is hugely, hugely popular. When I joined HashiCorp nearly 7 years ago, and we were talking about my role as a kind of an advocate and the tooling that, I remember the sort of, Armon was kind of saying, well, look, you know, Vagrant is not really something as we talk about as developer advocates, because the community is just so vast that it kind of is self-fulfilling, which is incredible. I mean, it's absolutely amazing. So yeah, Vagrant's still pretty big. Like, I don't know on the numbers. I don't know, but you're probably right. There's a huge amount of Vagrant still going on around there. I think if you don't use Docker for stuff, you're probably using Vagrant.
Before we go to the next question or next topic, I would like to thank our supporters on Patreon that help us produce this. So there is some cost with production of this podcast from audio to video. So I would like to thank our Patreons and our two sponsors, two companies are sponsoring this, or are our supporters, and that's 3FS and Human Frog. So thank you for that. Yeah. My question would be, I was having a presentation earlier today at a conference, and I was so surprised how Terraform really got popular in our region, and how many people know of it and how many people now use it at work. And I think that really changed in the last 2 years, because when I was picking it up, I was more of a lonely rider, super excited, so that I can basically spare some bucks when I go to lunch, because I can destroy the whole deployment. And then reapply it, and my Linode invoices were coming on 50 pages built for every minute, 2 cents, and then just pages and pages of VMs, and each line was just like 2 cents, 2 cents, 2 cents, because I was creating and destroying, creating, complying and destroying. But I would still like you to explain to more junior folks what Terraform is, and maybe, I guess, there are also some folks listening that are not super into infrastructure. What is this tool?
So I think it basically allows you to define infrastructure in a declarative way. So you can create a text file which defines what a piece of infrastructure might look like, a load balancer, a virtual machine, a network security group, those types of things. And you do that in a language, HCL, the HashiCorp configuration language, which is kind of a, I always think of it as if JSON and YAML had got together and had a child, HCL would be that child.
But it's a beautiful child.
It's a very pretty child. Yeah, it's like, I'm trying to think of, like, you know, Brad Pitt and who else is, anyway. But by doing that, what you get is the ability to define infrastructure. Now, what I think is important about Terraform is not so much the declaration. I think the declaration has been done before, but I think what's clever about Terraform is the fact that it uses a graph. So it's graph-based. So you can basically say that the output, for example, from a virtual machine, which might have the output of a private IP address, can be the input into another resource. So for example, a load balancer. And because of that graph base, what it means is that when you do your sort of your Terraform apply, Terraform works out the order in which it needs to create resources. So it knows that it can't create the load balancer until the private IP is available, which means it needs to create the virtual machine first. So it, like, that actually helps a lot, because it means that you no longer need to kind of have those exceptions or things. The other benefit is where you can parallelize things. So say you're creating 30 virtual machines, you don't need to do them in sequential order. Terraform can basically go, well, I'm going to create 30 at once, which reduces the time. So I think those are the, for me, those things that were like brilliant when I started using it. I think where I appreciate it moving forward as well is the feedback loop that Terraform gives me. So it will tell me what has changed. And I think that again is kind of the difference of when they were building the tool out. They think, right, okay, things needed to be graph-based because we needed this dependency, but we also need to give feedback because we want to understand what has changed. I don't want to just wipe out my infrastructure every time I do an apply. I don't want to kind of do this additive update. I want to be very prescriptive on those changes, what's changed, and understanding what's changed, which helps you to not make mistakes, which is always a benefit. And I think for those reasons is why it's been very, very popular for me as well. Like, I think it's the accessibility. So like, Terraform is the tool that led me to apply for a job at HashiCorp. Even though I was using Vagrant, I was using Consul at the time, and some Packer, I think. But I was working as a developer, and I wanted to deploy an application service. So I went to see our DevOps team, and I'm like, look, I want to deploy this service. It was actually a Lambda. And the team were like, well, we know nothing about Lambda, but we had a good DevOps culture. So they're like, look, if you can figure this out and you can help us understand what's going on here, mm-hmm. and you can do it in a way that kind of adheres to our principles, which is everything must be version controlled and CI/CD driven, then we will support you on whatever you want to do. And I thought, that's brilliant, right? So I went away and I looked at a number of different tools. They were using Ansible. I couldn't figure out Ansible. I mean, I'm kind of looking at a version. I'd used Chef before and I kind of got Chef. But at the same time, when I'm doing my research, I came across this thing called Terraform. And I'm like, immediately Terraform had the capability for me to deploy this Lambda. And I figured it out literally in an evening when I was just sitting on the sofa working, watching TV with my wife. And that was, you know, it just resonated. So then I took that back to the team and they're like, well, we don't use Terraform, we use Ansible. But again, we had this agreement. It's like, well, if it's simple enough, we can understand it and you understand it and you're happy, then we can come to a compromise. And that for me, when I was actually looking through that Terraform documentation and working through that role, and at the time I wasn't so happy in my current role. There were organizational challenges, mm-hmm. which was like sad because I loved the team and I loved the work. But there was a little link at the bottom of the Terraform documentation, which is like, come work at HashiCorp. And I remember sitting and complaining to my wife. And she said, look, why don't you just go find a new job? And I saw this link at the bottom of the Terraform documentation because I've been working out how to deploy my Lambda. And I clicked on it. And there was a role for a developer advocate based in the US. So I filled in the form and I sent off an email and I said, hey, look, I live in London, but I can move to the US, or can you possibly move the role to London? Well, 7 years later, I'm still there. I'm very fond of Terraform.
Yeah, maybe I can add a bit, like, I knew about Terraform and then I tried it out. And I don't know, that was, a few years back. And I really upped my game. So I would say, like, if you're interested in infrastructure, you really need to learn it. And for me, as a independent consultant, I need to try out a lot of stuff. So yeah. I don't move somewhere and I don't get super familiarized into AWS, into specific services that a company might use. So I want to maintain a broad knowledge of everything that is there, but I also want to dive in so much that I can deliver. And for me, so Terraform comes with providers which implement different cloud providers, and the documentation of all the resources in Terraform are kind of documented in a standard way because they just document the resources themselves. And for me nowadays, it's so much easier to try out different clouds.
Yeah.
Just like move around, just like use DigitalOcean, use Vultr, use Linode for my smaller companies, and then all the three big clouds for other customers. And it really, really helped me out. And I also didn't have this bad feeling, you know, when I came to the office and then I click around the dashboard the whole day.
Yeah.
Right. And then I was like, "Ooh, this is, well, kind of expensive, right? It will cost me probably, I don't know, 40 euros a day. But I don't want to delete everything right now because tomorrow morning I will have to do the same drill." Right.
And if you're clicking through a UI to do that, then you might not be able to reproduce it.
Exactly.
And I think this is a key thing as well. Like when people are saying, like, well, why should we bother using infrastructure as code? I can click a button to create my Kubernetes cluster. Or I can click some more buttons to set up the load balancer and the security rules and stuff like that. And that's great. But what if somebody comes in and deletes your project? And it was like, so my buddy Eric and I, we were doing a talk on Terraform for DigitalOcean a few years back. And the premise was all about using Terraform to provision DigitalOcean clusters. And so we're setting all of this up and we built everything up in Terraform. And Eric said, hey, can you, we had a couple of clusters. He's like, can you delete this cluster? So I went into the UI and I just clicked a button, and I deleted the wrong cluster. So I actually wiped out our main infrastructure cluster, and I'm like, yeah, Eric, I've just deleted the production infrastructure. And he's like, well, that was stupid. And I'm like, well, yeah, well, what do you expect? Anyway, but this was kind of going into the talk. And then I'm like, but hang on though, we've already defined this with Terraform. So Terraform apply. 5 minutes later, it was all back up, you know, and this was, it was kind of, in some ways, like, you know, we're doing this talk about why you should use infrastructure as code. And I'd actually proven the point by doing the thing that I was trying to say you shouldn't ever do.
Yeah.
And that was amazing. Like the ability to basically always reproduce what you've created just by running this one command, this Terraform apply, or tear it down again, being able to remove everything so you can save money, because it's not just production infrastructure that we've got. We've got test environments, thousands of dev environments, thousands of test environments, prod, pre-prod, like depending on the size of the organization, a lot of things. If you can define that declaratively, and you can be 100% certain, nigh on 100% certain, that when you do Terraform apply, you get exactly what you had the last time, then with safety, you can tear stuff down and you can start saving money and saving resources. But it also helps with experimentation. Mm-hmm. And I think this is like core to the ethos of where HashiCorp are thinking with things like Terraform and things like Packer about the, you might have heard the term cattle, not pets. I think it's core, right? It's like, so rather than having this additive process where you'll install software on top of software, what you do is you create something brand new, which has that combination stack, and you throw the old stuff away. And the reason for that is that it's reproducible. It's not always reproducible to recreate the layers if you've done that as in a sort of a layered approach, because software packages change. Software packages may be unavailable. There may be an outage. Like, what happens if there's an outage on apt and you don't have like a sort of a cache when you're trying to deploy some production infrastructure in the middle of an outage? Well, you're in trouble.
Yeah.
But if you take the kind of the declarative approach with Packer and you've got these baked images, then it doesn't remove the risk. It reduces the kind of the risk and increases speed as well. So I think it's a great tool. Like, I'm
I completely agree, and I'll ask for the audience or the let's say sysadmins who, or the companies that are not yet using Terraform or not yet trying to define their infrastructure as code. There's this question of how to introduce Terraform once you already have something deployed, so once like the production is already there.
Yeah.
So this is like the most common use case, what to do, because Terraform is great for greenfield deployment, for deploying something new, for starting from scratch, awesome.
Yeah.
What to do in cases when like there's so much legacy in production?
Well,
how to introduce? You have any bits and tricks how to do this kind of shift?
Yeah. So it's always been possible to terraformify. Is that, I probably created a thing. Like, if marketing are watching, I'm sorry. but terraformify is now a thing. It's always been possible to turn existing infrastructure into Terraform, because there's always been the import command. The problem that's always been with the import command is it would just bring in the state. So for folks who are not familiar with Terraform, you've got this concept of state, which defines what exists, and then your Terraform configuration is what will be. Now, when you've got an existing resource, you need configuration and you need state. So the import command would just create the state, which meant you then had to go and write the HCL for each of those things, which matched the state. And it was possible. I mean, you could automate it in some aspects, but it was time consuming. It was a bit of a chore. And there was tooling, I think it was Terraformer, it was maybe like a Google project, which could kind of do some of this stuff. But what we did in the last release of Terraform, which just came out this summer, is we've updated the import command. So now you can actually define an import stanza, point it to an existing resource in your cloud, and what Terraform will do is it will both import the state and it will generate the HCL for you. So you can take even large existing pieces of infrastructure and start kind of pulling them in, so you can start managing them with Terraform, which I think is a good step forward. And again, this isn't an early stage feature. It was only this summer, and there's a lot more to do with that. And of course, people like to modularize things. So it's not going to figure all of that out for you, but it's definitely better than having to like hand roll all of this stuff. So I think you can do it. And I think it's worth doing, but I think like, should you do everything? I mean, as an exercise, that could be expensive. So maybe what you've got to look at is what is changing all of the time. Mm. Like, so if, for example, you've got 20 servers and only one of them changes, maybe just the important thing is just to Terraform that one, one server. It doesn't have to be an exercise where it's all or nothing, but I definitely think there is a benefit that wherever there is change, that you, if you manage that change with Terraform, you are reducing your risk because of the knowledge you get from the change diffs. But again, that reproducibility, that consistency, the ability to recreate something if somebody goes into your production and clicks the big red button and then just blindly copies the delete thing into the box, and then realizes that was actually the wrong account that they've done it in, and they've just deleted the production cluster. Sorry,
Eric. That's a great disaster recovery exercise.
That's how we learn.
I mean,
right? Yeah.
If you did your homework right, and the Terraform like is written correctly, like this is one way to actually test it.
Yeah, and I think that's the nice thing, right? Like, so when you have this common workflow, Terraform will work with multiple clouds. It doesn't, like, if you can know how to, the resource stands for defining a virtual machine in Azure, AWS, is different to the one in GCP and in Azure and in DigitalOcean. Subtle differences, because each of those clouds have got different features and capabilities. But the thing is around the workflow, if you understand the workflow, if you understand how Terraform plan, how it apply works, how destroy works, how you define resources, and you can create variables and modularization, and then the kind of the workflow of automating that, so using Terraform within multiple environments and doing automated deploys, when you get good at that, what it means is that your disaster recovery is potentially getting tested every time you do a build. So if you do a build to dev, you're also kind of testing the Terraform code, which is going to deploy your prod instance. You'll catch things that maybe I'm using an out of date schema, or maybe there's a configuration problem. So I think it just massively reduces your risk and gives you this great capability to recover in the incident that something does happen, which has got to be a good thing.
Yeah, you're right.
Recently, there have been a lot of news about Terraform and a license change.
Yeah.
We just want to ask you, what's the fuss all about?
I mean, I think folks are, so there's been the change. So the change has been that we've relicensed Terraform Core to a BSL license, so that BSL license has certain restrictions on use. Now, without kind of going right into the terms of the kind of the legal side of things, the terms of kind of the restrictions are that for 99.9999999% of people who were using Terraform, they can continue to do so, and they continue to use it for free without any implications on the license. What the license change was kind of is really where it really starts restricting is if, for example, say you are building a Terraform cloud, then the license then starts coming into a force. So because you're creating a service using Terraform, which is in competition to one of HashiCorp's services. Now, again, I just want to kind of say that that's not necessarily a sort of a pure black or white thing, because we do have the capabilities around license exemption. So if you're, you know, say for example, you've got an internal platform which is using Terraform, and you're Maybe there's a gray area of it. You're in a competing business with HashiCorp. Can you still use Terraform? I mean, I think the answer is probably yes. But you know, the licensing folks will help you out, clarify yep. that. So I think a lot of folks were like, well, why did we do it? Is this not Mega Evil Corp? Are we kind of like, you know, are we going against the spirit of open source? And I think the key thing is that the code is still open now, so it is technically always going to be open. If you want, you can fork Terraform, and prior to the sort of the BSL license change, you can do what you want with that code. It's still I think it was MPL or whatever. Mm-hmm. So that, and the future code will always be publicly available, obviously with the BSL license. So as we add new features to Terraform, that code will be completely transparent and available inside of the public repo. And I kind of just want to add as well, it is sort of Vault, Nomad, Console, etc. Now, what we haven't changed on a licensing perspective are things like the providers, because the providers are in most instances not actually our code. So for example, the folks at DigitalOcean build their own provider. Google contribute to their own providers, as do Microsoft, as do sort of Amazon. That license hasn't changed. Why did we do it? I think that's the key thing. Like, why would you do this? I mean, the thing is that with HashiCorp invests and has invested over the sort of the last sort of 10 years, quite a large amount of money into Terraform. Obviously, Terraform would nowhere near be as popular as it is if it hadn't been for a wonderful sort of community contribution. But we have a huge number of sort of engineers and product engineers, huge amount of support that goes into that. Which way that we made money from Terraform as an entity, I mean, we're a company, it was through Terraform Cloud. And the kind of, I think the drive around the change is to kind of protect that investment, because if we can do that, what it means is we can keep those engineers, because we don't, you know, we want to keep the engineers and we want to keep innovating on Terraform. We want to keep putting that knowledge in. We want to keep it as an amazing tool that most of the community can use for free. And I think that was kind of the primary sort of motive behind the change. It's not that we're kind of moving this as a precursor to one day it's just going to be like, hey, we're going to stop using Terraform and everybody's being like hoodwinked and you're now going to have to pay us mega dollars to rebuild. No, not in the slightest. It's literally just, we're just trying to protect that investment. 99.99999% of people, you have, nothing's changed.
The main argument that I like saw from the community is like, this is so vaguely defined that like it's not black and white.
Yeah.
And it's hard to say. And I think this is the why everybody active in communities is sort of saying yeah. now that like HashiCorp is now the evil corp.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I'll be honest with you. I think we weren't the first people to do this.
Sure.
There's been a number of companies who've relicensed open source to protect their investments. And we probably won't be the last either. I think if anything, if there's criticism that we've maybe not managed the information on the change, then, you know, we'll take that and see if we can do a better job around that. I think it is complex because it is quite a, I mean, even if you read something like the MPL or a GPL license, they are, for me, I'm not a legal person. It's a complicated document. So maybe that is, that can be confusing that you look at this wall of text, but ultimately the key thing is that if you're not in an organization which is directly competing against any of HashiCorp services, you're unaffected. If you're unsure, then I think it's licensing@hashicorp.com. Mm-hmm. You can sort of get you in touch with somebody, or if you're coming to HashiConf, we're going to have folks there who will be able to help with licensing queries and things like that. We're more than happy to sort of clarify those. And I would like to bet that like most of the time it's going to be, you know, you're fine. And it's certainly nothing we wanted to do deliberately. You know, we didn't want to cause any upset. It wasn't anything sort of malicious or anything like that. We're really just trying to protect the investment so that we can keep investing and keep expanding Terraform's capabilities and make it a even better and better product and something we can use for the next decade as well.
I know if you can maybe like comment now that the community now opened OpenTF or OpenTofu. So basically, it's a fork of previous version of Terraform. I don't know.
Yeah.
What could we expect? Because we definitely saw this in the past.
Yeah.
In the end, this kind of fighting, it's not like it doesn't.
It's not good. No.
Yeah, of course. No. Doesn't bring any progress.
No, I mean, so I think, I mean, that was perfectly a legitimate thing. And so OpenTofu exists. It was created by a few organizations who were obviously affected by the license, but who also felt strongly about the license change and wanted to keep things on an MPL license. Now, what that they're obviously doing there, They've created the fork. They will then create a distribution and a registry and all of those sorts of things, which are in line with the sort of the license. I don't know what the future will hold. It's difficult to kind of to say, like, will one win out? Will we end up with the sort of the like Jenkins Hudson or something along those lines? I just don't know. Like, all I can say is that as an organization, HashiCorp is 1,000% committed to creating Terraform as the best tool that we can offer the industry to be able to create the best support and services around it, and that we're going to sort of continue to do that. Does it mean that sort of providers will kind of dry up and disappear then? You know, I mean, very possibly, right? Some people might determine that they no longer want to create a provider for Terraform. Some people might say they don't want to create a provider for OpenTofu. Some people might end up creating both and having to support the two. So it's, I guess, you know, it's early days. Like, I mean, we just have to wait and see how things, wait and things pan out. But as I say, all I can say is, as a HashiCorp representative, we are committed to keeping Terraform free for the very vast majority of people. We're committed to creating the best tool that it can be. And we genuinely love the community and everything that they've done to support that. And if anybody feels aggrieved by the things that we've done, and I can apologize personally from that, but it is, you know, it's a thing we want to keep things to be able to protect, and so we can keep it pushed forward. I don't know what else I can say around those things. I think it's
I can understand that, like, even company needs to do some trade-offs and like it can't be like win for everyone.
Yeah.
But in that sense, I completely understand you. I can also imagine like the fuss on the other side, but still.
Yeah, and I understand that as well. I mean, I am an open source user as well, but like for me, and I'll be honest with you, like, and I'm talking on a personal level here, not sort of ignore the H on my shirt, but when we made this sort of change and I sat down and I'm sort of in my head trying to rationalize, well, what does open source actually mean to me? And I thought about this and to be honest, I started looking and I'm like, I very rarely actually look at the license. The key thing for me was the ability to benefit from somebody else's learning, the ability to not have to reinvent the wheel. I mean, back to my JPEG example, you know, like not having to do that every time. And as a as somebody who has an open source project, spend a large amount of my own personal time working on, I'm even sort of thinking, well, you know, is the MPL license really, is it work for me as an individual? But in general, like the thing for me that's most important is that the source code still exists. I can still see what's going on. I can still learn from it. And I can still consume something which was always being intended, that we wanted to create something which was free to use, which benefits the community as a whole. So yeah, I don't know what do you think? I mean, you have opinions.
I'm sort of looking from the distance, because yeah, like you said, we saw that with like Mongo, we saw that with Elasticsearch, and I was never in a way affected. So like,
yeah,
me as a consultant, or me as a working for a company, but again, it really in the end differs whether this company is actually like selling this product, or what's building, like reselling this forward. And yeah, we saw that, like I in a way I understand both sides, like
yeah.
the way you explain it now, I completely get it. And I also understand the other side saying that like things are not like defined, the way that like there could be like exceptions or like,
yeah,
and so on. And
I think that's like, if I've got criticism around that, then I criticize the lawyers. And I think it's fair to have a kind of an inherent hatred of lawyers. I think they're generally kind of, we all want to kind of agree on one thing. But no, I mean, the legal document, and it is a kind of a legal document because it's obviously a contract, a license, is difficult. And it's what we've tried to do is make sure that the vast majority can continue as normal using Terraform as they always have, but have that clause in there which kind of stops folks from kind of like leveraging all of that hard work which again affects us to kind of invest in Terraform. And with always, when you end up with that sort of thing, it always becomes complex. It's not, because it's difficult to say who is a competitor, who isn't. And you can't really define that in the license. But again, to kind of reiterate those things, like, I think if you think that you're not sure that you're competing with HashiCorp, I think realistically you're probably not. And licensing at HashiCorp will be able to clarify that for you. And I think they'll sort of even give you sort of written confirmation that there's no sort of infringement of licensing. And I hope that, as I say, as time, this has only been what, a month or so,
yeah,
that no. we'll get a little bit more sort of used to kind of dealing with things. But yeah, like honestly, if there's anybody who has any sort of concerns, reach out to me. I'm more than happy to chat, to kind of put you in touch with people if you want to speak to some of the sort of, or get a sort of legal answer from HashiCorp's team, then we can arrange all of those sorts of things.
Awesome. Let's go to more relaxed topics. What do you do like to disconnect from all the technology? Do you have like any hobbies?
Yeah. So I like, well, so firstly, I do like sport. So I swim ultra, marathon distance and ultra marathon distance swimming. So basically anything, well, marathon distance in swimming is 10K and above. Mm-hmm. So I do a lot of that, which is, I find very meditative. Yeah. I mean, if you've, I don't know if anybody swims, or if you've ever swum sort of lap swimming, it's very, you know, meditative, especially when, if you're swimming front crawl and you're just kind of facing the water. I find that when you're swimming like between what could be 4 to 6, 7 hours. It's very, very relaxing. So I enjoy floating around in water as well. So there's, I do that. I do like video games. I kind of started falling into the slippery slope of sim racing recently, which I started playing Gran Turismo 7 in VR2. And I enjoyed that very much. And then all of a sudden a steering wheel appears in my house. And then before you know it, there's a seat. And yeah, that's been a slippery slope. And recently I've been getting into iRacing, which I'm quite enjoying. But I also like, you know, other video games. I've been playing Starfield, Baldur's Gate 3. Yeah, and well, and then of course I do a lot of writing, so I'm still working on my second book, which I'll hopefully get finished soon. I'm going to start a new YouTube channel with Ivan, who's hosting here today at DevOps Days, Ljubljana, called Doing DevOps, where we want to kind of get some education, put some education back. And so the concept is that Ivan has learned a lot across his career. And we want to be able to kind of put that back into helping people who were in the same position as he was when he first began. And it's always, I enjoy doing stuff like that as well. It's fun. I enjoy helping people. So yeah, pretty much I walk my dog. I'm trying to think, eating ice cream.
There are some nice ice cream shops in the center of Ljubljana. I can give you a list.
I'm hoping, yeah, later on today we'll maybe check something out.
Awesome.
But since you started like passing on like to newbies into this world. So for our audience, since there are a lot of like engineers who are now at the beginning of their career.
Yeah.
So, I don't know, what would be your advice, where to start if they are interested in exploring the DevOps culture and so on? What would be the tools to start learning, the things that should they focus on?
Well, I mean, I think you absolutely can't go wrong with Terraform. And whether you kind of you look at that as Terraform, OpenTofu, whatever, like as a tool and as a methodology, I think it's something that's kind of here to stay, I hope. So I think that's definitely something to look at. I think learning cloud is really hard. Like I spend a lot of time working between a number of different sort of clouds, depending on what I'm trying to sort of show. So I think doing, say, like your GCP, AWS, or Azure kind of certification is always worthwhile, because you can get a lot of value out of how best to sort of leverage cloud. I think folks like DigitalOcean are exceptional as well, like, because it's very accessible and you don't always need this huge amount of complexity. And DO does a very good cloud at a very good price. So I think, you know, looking at something like that. One thing I will say is that I think one of the things that helped me the most when I was learning was that by teaching, that helped me accelerate my own learning. And I will always say to people that, you know, you may not know as much as the expert, but I can guarantee you that if you know something, you know more than somebody else. So by passing that back and by kind of having this culture of sharing your knowledge, you're reinforcing that knowledge, but you're also kind of helping others who they can then in turn can help you, and then that really helps drive things. So folks like yourself, I'm always incredibly appreciative of, and thank you so much for running the podcast and helping get information out there. YouTube is incredible. I mean, I wish it existed when I was starting.
Yeah. Not the paper books, right?
Oh yeah, like I'm,
but I have like issues with like YouTube. Like I was sort of like getting knowledge from books or web pages. Like you can like scan to the point where you needed the information, because scanning to the video is problematic.
Yeah, I'm with you there. So I think now video seems to be the de facto standard around how information is produced. And so, for example, I'm going to give you a lightning talk later on today. And one of the things around the lightning talk is a slide every 15 seconds. There's a capability in Google Slides where you can set it to auto advance every 15 seconds. I could not figure out where this was. So I Googled it, and there was a video. And it was a 3-minute video, which told me to click on 3 options. So I think video is maybe not always the most appropriate source. As I say, like I've written one book, which published about 5 years ago. I'm working on my second one. I do like video. I enjoy creating video, and I quite enjoy watching video. But I do worry at the same time that we're not writing enough blog posts anymore. And the advantage of something like a blog post is it's very easy to index. So it's very immediate. If you want to look for a very specific thing, if that can be indexable through the Google search and just pop up in the search box, you can achieve something very, very quickly. Whereas if you get a video which has that information somewhere inside it, it can be a little bit slower. So, but some people hate reading. Like, you know, some people have difficulties with sort of following printed text. So having the medium of video is also very accessible at the same time, which I think is also a very good thing. It's like, oh, I think maybe we've got pros and cons.
Awesome. I think it's time for us to wrap up.
Yeah.
Nick, thank you very much for your time. Thank you for visiting Ljubljana.
Oh, I'm excited. It's a beautiful place.
Yeah. I would like to thank the organizers of DevOps Days. I would like to thank Andras.
Thanks.
I would like to thank the whole team at the back, Otto, Tomáš and Rok. Thank you very much. And I would like to thank our Patreons and the two companies that sponsor our production, 3FS and Human Frog. Have a nice day and see you soon. Or you will listen to us soon.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.